Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, September 16, 2013. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on the first and third Monday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember, our shows are available 24/7 on prn.fm and drsaputo.com.
Today, you'll hear Nurse Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we got another great show for you today that's going to include, are defective genes necessarily time bombs?
And how selective is our hearing?
Is having too few intestinal microbes qualify to be a real disease?
And can better pain management actually shorten hospital stays?
And what simple, non-invasive, inexpensive tests can measure the presence of arteriosclerosis?
Well, obesity and diabetes and heart disease and even cancer may very well run in the family, meaning that it's a trend within our immediate ancestry. But our growing urge to call something inherited isn't doing anybody any good because, you see, the health concerns that we often blame on our parents or our grandparents are usually within our control. So how common are diseases that we cannot manage by our environment and our lifestyle?
It's kind of the reverse of where we started years ago, you know, when DNA came out and Watson and Crick came out with their big model of how it folded together and that how it determined what our genes would be like. We thought that one gene would control one protein that would control one cellular behavior, and it made perfect sense. But according to some studies that have been done, two editorials in particularly summarize this. One was from Sayer G. from Green Med Info. By the way, this is a great site that I highly recommend people go to. And the other is Natural Society that was written by Elizabeth Renter. And they both reviewed all this, suggesting that your genes aren't time bombs at all. And most of the time, like 99% of the time, if you've got a defective gene, your environment will have a lot to do and determine its expression.
Well, I was surprised that less than 1% of all diseases caused by defective genes.
Well, it just shows you the power of epigenetics. I think that what we're looking at here is something that's almost shocking. You know, we only have 20 or 25,000 genes. We thought we'd have an enormous number that was bigger than that. And yet, when we did the testing on the human genome, we found that that was the case. And in fact, we have 100,000 proteins. So if it was one gene for one protein, we'd be short 75,000 genes. So that leaves you with epigenetics. So Bruce Lipton's work, you know, in the last decade or so, has really brought forward this whole topic of epigenetics and what it really means.
Well, basically to change our genes and our DNA with a healthy lifestyle and a healthy environment, and even by our thoughts and our feelings.
Absolutely.
Well, the other thing that's kind of upsetting is with all these genetically engineered foods, all the GMOs and so forth, because those can, they've found now, can change the good genes.
Well, they can turn on and off certain genes that you wish they wouldn't. And what we're going to have to do is find out the hard way what that is going to actually mean. So things like GMO wheat have been shown to silence human genes. That's like profound. And who really thought much about that?
Well, you know, it's like everybody pretty much eats wheat now, except for a lot of people are becoming sensitive to it and going on these gluten-free diets.
Absolutely, and it may have a lot to do with that. That may be what its relationship is all about.
Well, the gluten in the wheat, I think, is supposed to be like a natural pesticide.
Well, may well be, but so whatever it is, it raises havoc in the human body for about half of the population now.
When they change it, yeah, with the genetically engineered food.
Well,
and think of all the
things
that's in.
We don't know that. We just know that people used to be sensitive to gluten once in a while, like maybe one or two people out of 100.
Well, anyway, it's very difficult to avoid it because look at you. You've ended up now, you're on a gluten-free diet.
Yeah, I never would. It doesn't run in my family. I know that. And what had happened is I had fairly substantial arthritis in my hand. And I got to a place where I couldn't do my exercises the way I wanted to, playing tennis, because I couldn't hold the racket. And I decided to try and go off gluten. And as I did, all the symptoms have probably dropped about 90%. It also changed the nature of my bowels. So when we're looking at things like engineering food in a different way, it has a profound effect. I mean, we know we've reported on GMO stuff before on this show and talked about what happens when you look at certain kinds of viruses that are attached to the genes that are put into things like beets and whatever else is genetic corn that's genetically engineered. And two-thirds of them have this virus attached to it, which two-thirds of all the GMO foods that there are have this virus attached to it. It's called virus number 6. And that is a bombshell. What that could do could really be a problem. So if you want to learn more about
that,
that's what I'm saying. Go back to drsabuda.com and put in gene 6, and up should come a connection to take you to that article.
Well, you know what else I was surprised about? That even something as serious as cystic fibrosis might be preventable and even reversible when the gene is exposed to phytochemicals like turmeric and cayenne and soy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, doesn't that sound so simple? And yet this is such this horrible disease.
Well, it just shows you that the interaction of the environment, what you eat, what you're exposed to, has a huge impact on your DNA, your genetic makeup, and the composition of your genes that can actually determine which ones turn on and off. And in this particular case, in cystic fibrosis, there's a gene called the cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulator. That's what we call it, CFTR. It's too hard to say. May be preventable or even reversible, because what happens is there's a misfolding of the CFTR gene that has been shown to undergo partial or full correction, at least in a mouse model, for cystic fibrosis when they're in the presence of what you just said, the turmeric, cayenne, and soybean. The other thing they notice is that nutritional deficiencies like selenium, zinc, riboflavin, vitamin E, and others in the womb or in early life may trigger the faulty expression of the folding pattern. So these diseases that we're talking about are just amazing in how they're related to environmental changes. What we're really showing here is mind-boggling, because it's showing that the genes are beyond the control, or that the epigenetic factors really are more powerful than a gene in many ways and are beyond the control of the gene.
And look at how powerful we are and how powerful our minds are, because part of this included our feelings and our thoughts.
Absolutely.
And on the other hand, it's a lot of power if you can change your genetics.
Well, you can,
you know,
with your thoughts.
That you can take this active role in your health and your body and just embrace that power to change it.
Well, that's a surprise to most people. I think there is a big trend that's lessening, where things of this nature were thought to be woo-woo and that, you know, we could just forget it because it was so silly. But we have so many studies that have been done now that have been published in the scientific literature that show that our thoughts and feelings affects our biochemistry and physiology in a major sort of way.
And that's why it's so ridiculous when they always do these placebo-controlled studies, because
right,
they're not giving any power to the placebo effect.
Well, that may be the most powerful part of what happens. You know, we've reported on some studies where in irritable bowel disease, for example, there was a study done where people were given a placebo for 6 weeks and the other group wasn't given a placebo. But what they did with the group that was taking the placebo is they told them, they said, we're going to give you a placebo. And then they gave them a blue pill on which was written the word placebo. And the doctor said, please take it anyway, because we think it's possible that it could have an effect on you. And indeed, after 6 weeks, it did. Now, tell me placebo isn't a powerful tool that can powerfully affect what our genes are like and alter our DNA and change our physical characteristics of the diseases that we have.
So this is pretty powerful and pretty amazing information, particularly when you realize, again, that less than 1% of all diseases caused by defective genes. 1% is not very much.
Well, what does it tell you about cleaning up the environment? How important could that be?
I know
we've got 100,000 chemicals or more that have been put into our environment in the past 50 years, and we haven't had time for our bodies to learn to detoxify them. We don't have the genetic makeup to act that quickly in that setting. so that we're protected against what we've poisoned ourselves with. And it may be what's going to lead to our demise.
And we don't want to give up that power and be victims.
Right. Well,
you know, I heard on the news yesterday that they found that Motrin for babies now, they found it has plastic in it.
Well, there was some mistakes that led to that.
Yeah, but I mean, we've got plastic all over the place.
Oh,
and
sure.
There's a lot of things in our environment that personally, it's a big challenge to try to change it. You know, we have to work together and get everybody to want to change it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. And until we inspire people to be more interested in service than in profitability, we're going to continue with the same model that we have, so that if there's a chance that people can profit personally from something, they do that. And that's why we've got America, in fact, we've got the whole world in a state of massive pollution.
I think we can't say enough that people have to take responsibility for their own health. And one of the ways to do it is to listen to our shows, because this is what we're trying to teach everybody, is to take responsibility for their health, because and not to just accept what your doctor tells you or any other healthcare practitioner. You need to do your own research on it. You need to get other opinions about things.
You
can't trust that bottled water that you bought hasn't been sitting in some place where there's been a lot of heat that's melted and what do you call it?
Well, it outgasses the plastics that are in it and are coated with things that are not healthy for us.
And not to be using the microwave oven unless it's, you know, to heat up compresses or something. It changes the molecular composition of the food. You don't want to later on be saying, oh, I wish I'd done this or I wish I'd done that. I wish I hadn't done that.
Well, here's the problem, Vicki. It feels hopeless. You know, you see the oil refineries close to where we live, and all the pollution comes from that. We've got all the other kinds of industrial world that's producing all these pollutants that are covering the planet.
And the oceans with the Fukushima.
That's even beyond belief. And when that all happens, how much good do you think you can do by cleaning up the water you're drinking or by doing a single thing? And while it doesn't seem like much, it's the only thing you can do. And if you're inspired to do that and you take it a step further and you take an active role politically and economically to not support the things that are deteriorating our planet and poisoning us so that we become like a bacterial colony in a petri dish that has a normal lifespan that has a lag phase, which means it grows slowly, then a log phase where it means it grows like heck, and then a pollution phase where it kills itself and then it dies off. That's what's happening to the human race.
Well, we've done a pretty good job of polluting everything, our water and our air. And
our food. And our soil. There's nothing left that's not polluted. Where can you go? Even the oceans now are polluted.
And
with
so
things.
If all that radiation comes here.
From Fukushima? Well, it
will. Well, then everybody's going to get cancer. Then
well, not everybody's going to get cancer, but there's going to be an increase in risk for it.
So
and
what we can do individually is to do what we can for ourselves to try to build up our wellness buffer to have it not affect us.
But well, there we can consume more in the way of antioxidants. And, of course, even then, the best way to develop an antioxidant is what? Exercises, not supplements. But
yeah,
you
go
may
out
be driven
and
to have to do
in that polluted air.
Well, I mean, that's,
take a deep breath.
Well, that's right. There's not much you can do about Fukushima. That's a done deal. It's over. What you can do is stop running the risks that we run by using nuclear power in a lot of places in the world. I mean, let's face it, only two places have had meltdowns, Chernobyl and Fukushima. There are hundreds and hundreds of other places, and they're built on faults, and they do have a natural lifespan. What happens inevitably when some of them also do the same thing?
Nobody's
and
planning ahead.
And then they have this
ahead.
Massive pollution that goes with it.
So we need to vote.
We do more than vote. We need to change the way we think and operate. It's not all just about us. It's about the community. It's about the planet. It's about the universe. How do we do our role to make the universe a better place and do it thoughtfully? We have to have an interest. We need to be motivated. We need to be inspired to the point where it becomes something that we want to do that is important enough that we'll do it just to set the example.
Well, that's where I think sometimes online, when you go to Facebook and things, where people are expressing their opinions and sharing and so forth, because it gets information out there sometimes that you don't get otherwise.
Well, how do you get Joe Sixpack to want to do that, right? The average American that's not that well educated to really pay attention to it because they have faith that the government's taking care of us. It's taking care of us all right, but not the way that we need it.
And so then Joe gets sick and he goes to the doctor.
And he trusts that everything that's going to happen to him is the right thing. And, of course, we know that that medicine is extremely complicated to practice. I can tell you that there's hardly anyone on the planet who could practice medicine perfectly. You know, when you take your boards in a specialized field like cardiology or nephrology or gastroenterology, if you get 80% of the questions right, you pass your boards.
That what about those other 20?
Well, that's the point. And then we're talking about all the things that medicines and the technologies can do that have side effects that can cause us problems is massive. And what are we focused on? Helping people to get better and doing what we know about so that we can use our skills to help people get better.
And we need to prevent it in the first place.
Well, that's right. And when you go to the butcher shop, you're not going to order broccoli. If you go to the surgeon, okay, he's not going to she's probably not going to tell you that you don't need a surgery. But there are a few surgeons who are like that, who don't want to do that. I know one in particular that I work with that oftentimes says, you know, I think there's a better way to do it than just to do it by using a surgical procedure here. And those are the people that are really special. They can take us in the right direction whose primary interest is
the patient.
What's the best thing for the patient rather than the convention says do this? Because if you act that way and you just follow the rules that are written in books that we learn about, medicine isn't one size fits all. It's very complicated. Everybody is different. And we need to pay attention to those differences so we can apply the right treatments for each person. And they have to engage. We have to engage the families with this, too. And their whole support system. We're not just treating one person when somebody comes into our office. We're treating a whole community of people that are connected to that person and a whole state or country or world that's connected to that. And we forget about this in our dualistic way of looking at things rather than realizing that the oneness of all that there is. Every time you do one thing that's not to the advantage of the system, it affects the whole system.
It's like throwing the stone in the water and watching all those ripples.
Those ripples are where things start. You know, the butterfly wings in Japan may be the first thing that starts the tsunami. Who knows? You know, but you got to start doing what you can to support the right thing because the buck stops with you as an individual. And that's the only way we're ever going to see meaningful change of a massive nature that seems overwhelming.
And like I said earlier, don't be a victim. You know, recognize your own active role in the health of your body and just embrace that power and change it. And don't blame your genes or anybody else.
You do what you can.
Do what you can do.
Try to do the right thing. Try to build community, and remember, it's not all about you.
And knowledge is power.
Exactly. Okay, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on homemade mosquito repellent and four short tips. And then we'll be talking about how selective is our hearing.
SWAT! Nobody wants a mosquito bite.
I'll say.
Or an ant, or a red ant bite, or a flea bite. And it's really good to have a recipe that's free from chemicals that can possibly poison the body.
That's the problem with most repellents, huh?
Yeah, well, recently we heard of somebody that we know that had dengue fever in the Philippines.
Right.
And you can die from that. It's very serious. And you
can
get that from mosquito bites. And I guess malaria is from mosquito bites.
A lot of mosquito-borne diseases.
And recently we've been hearing about the West Nile virus again.
Sure.
So I thought it'd be a good time to mention this simple little recipe. So get your pencils and papers out so you can write this down.
All right.
So what you need is a half a liter of alcohol. That's like about 500 cc's or about 2 cups, whatever is easier for you to measure out here. And 100 grams of whole cloves. So that comes to about a half of a cup of whole cloves. And 100 cc's or 100 milliliters of oil, like almond, sesame, chamomile, lavender, fennel, an oil like that. Mm-hmm. So that's like a little bit less than a half a cup. So what you do, it's really easy. You just leave the cloves to marinate in the alcohol for 4 days and then stir it every morning and every night. So just twice a day, just stir it up. And after 4 days, add the oil, and now it's ready to use. So you just rub a few drops on the skin of the arms or the legs, and the mosquitoes are going to just flee from the room, and it repels fleas on pets also.
Is that right? That's great.
Yeah, so I thought that was a good tip. Now, I have a few other little tips that I got that I like here. Being a good person does not depend on your religion or status in life, your race or skin color, political views or culture. It depends on how good you treat others.
So right.
You know, I do 5 sit-ups every morning, and it might not sound like much, but there's only so many times you can hit the snooze button.
You're right. Then the guilt takes over, right?
You know, cuddling literally kills depression. It relieves anxiety and strengthens the immune system.
That's a good plan. Want to cuddle?
Let's snuggle.
Okay.
Learn to appreciate what you have before time makes you appreciate what you had.
Oh, so true.
Yeah.
Usually we find that out a little bit too late, huh?
That's right. Okay, so if you're still struggling with that recipe, it's alcohol, whole cloves, and oil.
Cool.
Okie dokie. Now, sometimes we just seem to know things, and when there's a study, we feel like, well, what's new with that? I already knew that.
Uh-huh.
It's common knowledge that as we age, our hearing often becomes impaired.
Right.
What?
What? Yeah, right.
And one of the most difficult situations is to hear when in a crowd or with background noise. Mm. And now a new study shows that it's easier to hear a familiar voice. Mm-hmm. So how is this information useful? Just take your spouse with you wherever you go, because their voice is more familiar.
Well, it means a lot more. I mean, you've had lots of experience with this person. You're really familiar with what's happening. So when you hear it, it triggers a response. It's immediate. And you tend to focus in on that. And that's what happens. And as we get older, as we lose some of the mental skills that we have, if we do, it's really good to have a familiar voice around, because that's the one that will be the one that you can hear the best and will mean the most to you.
So it's really important to visit your loved ones if they're in a hospital or a board and care facility, a nursing home, whatever.
Even if they can't respond to you verbally, your presence there.
And your voice.
is powerful stuff that will make a connection for them. Think of the prison a lot of these people are in when they lose those skills. They can't communicate. And they give up on hearing other people's voices. And the study that was done shows that.
And then, too, a lot of people are in homes where they don't speak much of their language, you know. They might speak another language, and that makes it even more difficult.
It tough. I mean, you feel isolated, disconnected, and it can lead to depression and anxiety. You're lonely. There's no way to what's life without having social ties.
Communication.
Yeah. You got to be able to understand it.
So what did they have to say about ignoring your spouse's voice?
Well, we practice that, I think, sometimes, Vicki. You know, for me, of course, it's different, because when I'm deeply in the zone or I'm in the moment and I'm concentrating on something, I don't hear anything. It's sort of like and that may not be true all the time here.
Well, I know some other things.
If you ask me to do something on my honey-do list, I may not be listening.
That's what I mean, I
can hear you, but I may not be listening.
If you don't want to hear it, you're not going to hear it.
Yeah, but when I'm on a tennis court, okay, and I'm in a big match and I'm focused, I'm in this place called the zone, where I'm totally focused on what? Just watching the ball and making things happen in a spontaneous way without having any judgments about it.
You're pretty much like that when you're on the computer, too. Well, I've tried talking to you when you're on the computer. That doesn't work either.
Well, I can't hear you, right? It's like a kid, you know, say a 4-year-old kid who sees this beautiful flower and there's a bee on it, and they're so focused on it. All they can see is that bee and the flower, Johnny, it's time for lunch. Johnny doesn't hear anything. He's looking at the bee on the flower. He's totally focused on that.
And he's getting in trouble because he didn't come.
Well, that's right. And as we get older, we learn to become distracted and accept distraction as something that's okay. And it is and it isn't. It depends on what it is. Our gift from the universe is to be in the moment all the time. We are like present tense organisms. We're always in the present tense. And if we don't go as deep as we can, we just miss out. And how deep can you go? You'll never know until you go deeper, deeper. And when you're deeper, go deeper again. And that is what life, in a large part, is about.
And that's what people are trying to accomplish all the time with meditation and yoga. And
just being present.
Yeah. And focusing on the breath. So what was this about understanding a spouse better?
Well, I mean, what do you mean understanding a spouse better?
Well, one of the things in this article is they talked about understanding your spouse better, the voice. And I was thinking,
oh, the familiarity of the voice. Oh, for sure.
No, but understanding. And I was thinking,
you will. That's true.
Because that really does work for me. Because once in a while, if somebody else tells me something, mm-hmm. that doesn't hold or says something that doesn't really hold my attention or I don't really quite understand what they're saying, I know that if I just ask you later, you're going to say it in a way and I'm going to understand. Mm-hmm. Have you ever listened to somebody and you just hear the words, but you can't really get inside of what they're saying?
Sure. And it may be too much work or you don't care or you don't understand it.
Well, we learned an exercise in improv class that was called mirroring. So when the person's talking and you finding that you're having trouble following or listening to them, in your mind, you're supposed to be mirroring the words that they say.
It's so pretty hard to do.
As you're saying something, I'm repeating it to myself, what you're saying.
So you're really hearing, really listening.
That's supposed to be a tip. But
Well, here's a study that was done, okay? It was published in a journal called Psychological Science, and what they did is they got married couples who are between the ages of 44 and 79, and they got each of them to make a recording of themselves in a scripted instruction sheet. They did it out loud. Then they recorded it, and later on, each participant put on a pair of headphones and listened to the recording of his or her spouse as it played simultaneously with the recording of an unfamiliar voice. So you had two voices going at the same time. And what they found was it was much easier and more accurate to follow the task when they listened to their spouse.
Well, that kind of makes sense because that's the voice you hear the most.
It does. And what they found is that the other voice was really a lot more difficult. So the benefit of familiarity was huge here. But when they looked at age, they found that as we age, we could follow the other voice less well. So in middle-aged adults, they seemed to be pretty adept at following an unfamiliar voice, especially when it was masked by their spouse's voice. So they were better at understanding the unfamiliar voice when it was masked by their spouse's voice, because we get good at practicing not listening to our spouse sometimes, right? And so when that happens, you perfect it, I guess.
Well, I have to tell you too what my hearing doctor told me, because I've got a little hearing loss.
Right.
And he said, when your husband talks to you and you can't hear him, it's his responsibility to talk louder or to come into the same room and to respect that in you rather than putting you in the position of having to follow him around and go in the other room to get him
to
talk louder.
Well, it works both ways, my dear. Okay. I mean, if you really want me to hear something or you want to, if we're talking together, maybe you should be closer.
No, if you're in the other room, it's not right to say something to me when I can't hear it.
Like
it's not a good idea for you to be telling me something important if I have the hair dryer going.
Well, that's true. I mean, that's absolutely true.
And this goes for all the spouses out there.
That's right. So there, right? Make sure that that's the way it is. So we can block things out better if we have a familiar voice. The content matters, because if you're trying to tell your spouse about something you want them to do and they don't want to do.
Maybe you should do it in an accent.
You want me? Well, that would arise some curiosity. That's right. And you might listen a little bit more carefully. No doubt about that. Okay. So It's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. We'll be right back with more Prescriptions for Health Radio, and we'll be talking about, is having too few intestinal microbes qualify to actually be a disease? Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki.
So guess what's new in the news again? Well, this week we have three new articles on healthy intestinal bacteria and its importance. And you may have heard us say that intestinal bacteria is now considered an organ.
Hard to believe, isn't it? We think that poop is something you just want to get rid of, right? Down the drain and out of sight.
Well, the other thing is that it can weigh in at 3.3 pounds.
All right.
So you think this balance of trillions of bacteria is important? Well, you bet it is.
Absolutely. When you look at the normal functions, okay, of the stool bacteria, it metabolizes hormones and carcinogens and xenobiotics, those things in the environment that are toxic to us. It makes vitamins such as vitamin K, B5, B6, and biotin. It has the ability to make short-chain fatty acids like butyrate, which is a major metabolic fuel of the colon. And if you don't have that, the colon can't be well. It crowds out pathogenic bacteria. And it stimulates the immune system to be more powerful and serve us well.
And it can also increase weight gain and the risk of diabetes and cardiovascular disease.
Right. The amount of material that these organisms make is fantastic, and it affects every organ system in the body. It's as important as a liver or a kidney. And when it's not there in the right amounts, we got trouble. They did a study that looked at intestinal bacteria from 292 people who were Danes that showed that about a fourth of those people had less than 40% of the number of bacteria that they should have. And they also found that they had reduced bacterial diversity, meaning fewer different kinds of bacteria there. And they also harbored more bacteria that cause low-grade inflammation.
So we need to have a proper balance of the healthy, friendly bacteria and the bacteria that we want to get rid of.
Right. And just think of what happens when you destroy that ecosystem. You know, it's like looking at a rainforest and a big fire goes through it. You can't take a bunch of seeds and throw them out there and think that you're going to have the recovery of an ecosystem that complex in a matter of a few months.
And this is one of the things that happens with antibiotic use.
Sure. And a lot of the things that are toxic in the environment, some of the things in our food that are an issue, it may be even related to some of the GMO products that we have that could affect the gene content of the microbes that live in the gut.
Also, you know, it's overdone with a lot of the antimicrobials, you know, and the soaps and the toothpaste and the hand sanitizers.
They're all over the place. We're busy killing bugs all the time, and we forget that the ecosystems in the rest of the body are important, too. On the skin, in the eye, in the mouth, and the nose, and the vagina, they're all ecosystems that are different. And if we're constantly washing or putting toxic things on there that kill these microbes, what does it do? It opens up the whole area there for the development of other microbes to grow there because there's open turf. Not a good
when
idea.
I was in nursing school in the olden days,
yeah, right.
One of the things that they taught us about a lot was about germs, particularly with infants, mm-hmm. and how important it was to have everything sterile, and you sterilize the bottles and the formula and the mothers. We were supposed to teach mothers to cleanse their breasts with Visihex and rinse it all off before they breastfed their babies and to clean the toys and sterilize the pacifiers and all that sort of thing. And now they found that bacteria in a pregnant mother's gut goes to her baby's goes to her breast milk and then to her baby, and so that it's important for the baby's gut health and the immune system. And so I think that all that we used to do in that regard was overdone.
Oh, it may have caused problems. I mean, we're back with the old Pasteur and Beauchamp argument, where Pasteur who discovered the germ, says the germ is what causes all the problems. And Beauchamp says, no, it's not just that. It's also the defenses of the human body. And if you wipe out all these ecosystems with whatever you're doing to try and, quote, sterilize things, you're just inviting pathogenic microbes to take that space over and create problems.
And so maybe babies' formulas, if they're not breastfeeding, should be fortified with probiotics. And I was also
Absolutely.
Thinking that pregnant mothers should probably have some probiotics along with their prenatal vitamins.
Well, it would be a good thing. It would be a better thing for them to eat healthy foods and to live a lifestyle that was healthy, because that's a natural way of creating a normal ecosystem that has the right microbes in it. So this whole business of the ecosystem of the gut is really important. And if it goes bad, some of the things that happen is if you have abnormal microbes in the gut, it deactivates digestive enzymes. It can lead to maldigestion and malnutrition. It can consume vitamin B12 and certain amino acids. It can saturate the essential fatty acids. It can disrupt the lining of the intestinal tract and cause leaky gut syndrome. It can sensitize bacteria that come across the gut and into the body that also lead to autoimmune diseases. Lots of things like that. Irritable bowel syndrome, the yeast overgrowth problems, the deconjugation of bile acids and estrogens that can lead to cancers. So it's really vital that this ecosystem be treated with kid gloves. And it maintains our health. I mean, how long do you think it takes to restore a microbiome, which is what the microbes in the gut are called, when we have something happen to it? It makes you appreciate the role of the appendix. You know, a lot of us don't understand that.
Yeah, there was a study a while back, a few years ago, that showed that the appendix actually had a function, whereas before that, they'd say, oh, while we're in there doing this other surgery, let's take it out.
Just get infected.
So you won't get appendicitis.
So what does it have in it? It has all
probiotics.
Yeah, it's got all these natural reserves of different kinds of microbes that live there that are far better and effective than any probiotic you could take. Because
so it kind of makes you think
stuff.
If somebody's had an appendectomy that they should maybe take probiotics, huh?
Well, I think so, yes. And look at the role of mother's milk in this setting. I mean, if it has all the right microbes in it that are right for the baby, how can you possibly replace it with something like infant formula?
And how can these probiotics be related to obesity?
Well, that's an interesting question. The way they found in this study that the people who had fewer and less diverse intestinal bacteria are more obese than the rest of the people that were in it. They also found that there was a preponderance of bacteria that had the potential to cause mild inflammation in the digestive tract in the entire body, which was reflected by blood studies that looked at markers like the C-reactive protein.
You know, too, we know that diabetes and heart disease are associated with being obese.
Yep.
And now they're saying that it's associated with this imbalance of the intestinal flora.
There is an association. It doesn't mean it causes it, but it's something that needs to be studied. And associations are important, but they are not diagnostic. And that's why we need more studies to look at this.
So do you think that this microbiome, as you call it, has the ability to turn genes off and on?
Absolutely. And I think that's what we're looking at is epigenetics again. You got the wrong bugs in there, the wrong mix of microbes, and you got the wrong genes that are being turned on and off. And when you talk about this business about being overweight, if you put some, it's very related to the diet of what you eat. They put people who are overweight on a low-fat diet for just 6 weeks, and what they found was a group of overweight individuals who had fewer and less diverse intestinal bacteria who were on this diet were able to increase the growth of the right bacteria that really was to their advantage to do it. So we're looking at something here that's actually an organ.
But they also didn't say what kind of fat.
No, so they didn't.
Yeah.
They didn't. But that, I mean, and that would be important to know, too. I think everything that you eat, that you process, will have an effect on allowing the microbes in the gut to grow.
Because we know that trans fats are bad and deep fried foods
are not a good idea. But look at other things, too. Put gluten in there and see what happens. You're going to kill some of the good microbes that you want there, apparently. Or what if you put other things in there that shouldn't be that are in the diet? Like, what if you're sensitive to milk?
Or gluten or preservatives or just any food additives?
Well, what you put in your body makes a big difference in terms of what's going to happen to the microflora of the gut, because there's a turf war going on in there. All these bugs are trying to take over as much space as they can. So it's an important concept. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and it's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on a safe landing. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, can better pain management shorten hospital stays? And what simple, non-invasive, inexpensive test measures for the presence of arteriosclerosis?
Abe and Esther are flying to Australia for a 2-week vacation to celebrate their 50th wedding anniversary. Suddenly, over the public address system, the captain announces, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid I have some very bad news. Our engines have ceased functioning, and we will attempt an emergency landing."
Oh, jeez.
"Luckily, I see an uncharted island below us, and we should be able to land on the beach. However, the odds are that we may never be rescued, and we'll have to live on the island for the rest of our lives." Well, thanks to the skill of the flight crew, the plane lands safely on the island, and there are no injuries. An hour later, though, Abe turns to his wife and he says, "Esther, did we pay our Visa and MasterCard bills yet?"
Oh,
"No, sweetheart." Abe's still shaken from the crash landing and he says, "Esther, did we pay our American Express card yet?" "Oh, no, I'm sorry. I forgot to send the check." "Well, one last thing, Esther. Did you remember to send the estimated earnings check to the IRS this quarter?" "Oh, forgive me, Abe," begged Esther. "I didn't send that one either." He grabs her and he gives her the biggest kiss in 40 years. And Esther pulls away and asks him, "What was that for?" He says, "They'll find us."
Oh, they'll find us. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Humor's the best medicine.
That's right. Laughter's the best medicine.
Oh, that's great.
Colorectal surgery or bowel resection can be very painful, and patients are at risk for complications. And it's now been shown that a transversus abdominis plane block, or a TAP, can improve outcomes as well as other protocol. So let's talk about what a TAP block is and how it reduces complications.
Okay. Well, it doesn't reduce complications so much, but it certainly reduces the pain that people have. And they can send them home sooner. So what they're doing is they're putting a nerve block in between the muscle planes of the abdomen after they've done a surgery on the abdomen. And what they found is that people were able to go home a lot sooner and did a lot better. For example, they had 65 patients that they studied. 27 went home in 24 hours.
Well, that's how impressive. It reduces the complications.
Well, maybe. 35 people went home in 48 hours, and 11 people were in there with complications, which means it's about 17% that actually have complications from that surgery. That's a big number. So, yes, there's value to this, and it was published in the Journal of the American College of Surgeons in August of 2013. So we're looking at something that makes sense in terms of making people feel better. And, of course, what they conclude is that patients who stayed longer in the hospital tended to have more complications. But I'd say it the other way around. People who tended to have complications spent more time in the hospital. So that's just kind of a euphemistic way of giving the study a little bit more credibility.
Okay, let's go back a little bit here. Now, if you can reduce the pain with one of these blocks where they inject a local anesthetic, it helps the patients to not take so many narcotics, for one thing.
Yes.
And the patient's going to be more comfortable and so forth. They can walk better. They can do their deep breathing and their coughing easier. This always, required that they do. And
well, it prevents pneumonias for sure.
Yeah. So it says that patients who stay longer in the hospital tend to have more complications. Well, the complications that they were talking about were urinary tract infections, GI bleeds, and small bowel obstructions.
Right. Well, those would have occurred in any event. So what we're looking at is a 17% complication rate from that surgery.
Yeah, so that's why the patients have to stay in the hospital. But they said if they go home earlier, then they have less readmission rate. But like you said, maybe that's because they didn't have a complication.
Well, that's right. So they did pretty well.
But, you know, I know when I was in the hospital, when I had my shoulder surgery for a really serious rotator cuff that I had, when that block wore off, the pain was absolutely excruciating.
Yeah.
And the nurse came in the room because I put on the light. She came in the room and she said she couldn't give me anything for pain.
Right.
And I said, well, then give me a washcloth. And she says, what for? And I said, so I can bite on it. And she practically threw it at me and goes out the door and shuts the door. She had no empathy or feelings or anything, like to stay with me, to try to comfort me, or to say, I'll call the doctor and see if he'll order something.
We get so involved with the technology of what we do that we do a one-size-fits-all approach.
Well, they should have an order that as soon as a block wears off, to be prepared to give them something for the pain.
Well, they obviously screwed that up.
Well, so anyway, my pain became out of control, and I had to stay in the hospital for an extra day. They called it for pain management because I couldn't have gone home with pain like that.
Oh, no, I understand.
And I know a lot of times that there are things that can be very helpful for pain, you know, like acupuncture and the photon stimulator and DMSO and breath work, but there are certain times like what they're talking about here, because this is a very painful surgery to have these colon resections and bowel resection and so forth.
Well, these things are, I mean, the point I'd like to make from this is not so much that everybody should have an injection and a block after surgery. Fact is, I don't recommend that, despite the fact that that's one approach that you could take. There are definitely better approaches to take that are non-invasive, that don't involve injections, that work better. And I'd use combinations of them. How long is it going to take us to learn about acupuncture? We know that acupuncture works as a general anesthetic. Why in the hell aren't the anesthesiologists doing acupuncture for major surgeries? We know that. We saw it in about 1970 when Nixon came back from China with this film of a man having open chest surgery who was eating an orange and he was awake and all he had was a few acupuncture needles in his neck and a couple of other places to relieve pain. Why hasn't that? It's been 40 years. How long does it take to learn it?
I saw a C-section with hypnosis.
Absolutely. And what about the infrared light, you know, our photon stimulator? That thing works just like a nerve block, and it speeds up healing as well as making the inflammation go down, improving the circulation, and working on the nerves to relieve pain. So we could do that, and what I would recommend is that for almost every person who has surgery.
You know, a lot of the hospitals claim that they have departments where they do acupuncture and massage.
Well, they don't do them in the hospital. See, they've got departments, but
they
those
have
are
an outpatient.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about integrative practice.
Well, because they should send those people up to the floors.
Well, absolutely. I mean, why is it just outpatient? And a lot of that is because that's what the doctors want. What they don't understand, they categorically throw out. Oh, acupuncture couldn't possibly do what the drugs are. But they didn't see that movie, from China, that Nixon brought back.
Well, then also there's breath work.
Sure. Your breath can have a profound effect on how you perceive pain.
What's the name of that breathing machine? There's a breathing machine that Naringen talks about, where you put these nasal cannulas in your nose and you hear your own breath.
She has an app, that can be used to help people lower their blood pressure, to help work with sleep apnea, to work with reducing pain. Lots of things that breath work have applications for. But we've got this one-sided approach where we look at what we do in medicine as the only way to look at things. And we haven't extended the boundaries of what our capacity is in these other areas. I mean, things like DMSO, dimethyl sulfoxide. I mean, when I first heard about that about 25 years ago, and my coach, my tennis coach, said, what about that? I said, that's probably a toxin. It's a poison. Don't use it because...
Yeah, a lot of people think it is. But
if you don't study it, don't say it.
Yeah.
And I was guilty of it as well.
Well, it's an antioxidant, it's anti-inflammatory.
Oh, it does so many good things. And it's a powerful way to relieve pain. If you have a burn, for example, and you put that on a fresh burn that's a third-degree burn, the pain will disappear within seconds, 15 or 20 seconds.
Well, some of the other things that they said that would help a patient be discharged earlier from the hospital was to get them up walking sooner.
Yeah, those are good things to do.
And, you know, if your pain is less, you're going to be able to get up and walk sooner. And they also talked about eating the next day. Now, that's interesting because usually you wait for bowel sounds before somebody can...
Well, the problem was is we made the assumption that if there weren't good bowel sounds and if patients had any kind of problem at all, you leave that nasogastric tube in so that they don't vomit and aspirate into the lung and wind up getting a pneumonia. So I understand that. But now that we know better, I mean, eating after the first day from a surgical procedure is a great idea because it sustains the gut's villi, little villi that are in there that do the absorbing. Once you've had no food in the gut for a period of about 3 days, all those things disintegrate and you have to regrow them, and it takes time. So these are good things that this Case Medical Center study showed, but I think that we need to extend the boundaries of what that does.
You know, there are many high-tech and invasive tests that are helpful for doctors to diagnose the stiffness of our blood vessels, which is a risk factor for arteriosclerotic heart disease,
right,
and strokes. And many of the carotid scanning tests can pose risks. Things like angiograms and CTs with dye contrast
dye. Yeah, and the dye is nephrotoxic, meaning it could be poisonous to the kidneys. And you certainly don't want to use something you don't have to.
So we're going to talk about a simple, safe, effective, non-invasive, and inexpensive test that we'd like to see in mainstream medicine, the vascular stiffness test.
Right. And what you do is you just measure the shape of a pulse that's in the finger. And the shape of that pulse depends on the elasticity of arteries. So when arteries get stiff, that pulse gets flattened out and it becomes long and it loses its volume. But when there's a lot of elasticity, you see nice big changes in that, and you can make the diagnosis of whether or not the arteries are stiff or not. So it's a great test. And these people who studied this and published in the American Journal of Physiology are reinventing something that we already knew.
And it's just a little cuff they put on your finger. They don't even stick your finger with a needle.
No, right.
And because some of the other tests that check for the stiffness are the carotid and femoral arteries,
yeah,
where they thread a catheter up in there.
A little bit more invasive. You don't
need ultrasound, and then there's MRIs with contrast.
Sure.
So, but this vascular stiffness test could actually even be done in the doctor's office.
Oh, it is. A lot of doctors do that. Cardiologists don't generally do that. But people who aren't up on what's happening do it. We offer that test, of course, because we know that it's a valuable test. And we do that in conjunction with two other tests if we're trying to assess somebody's risk for developing a heart attack or a stroke.
But these tests show the narrowing of the arteries from the arteriosclerosis, where the plaque builds up and then the arteries stiffen.
It's the stiffness that it measures. It doesn't tell you where the plaques are, and it doesn't do anything about them, but it certainly tells you that you have them.
So it's the first step, and it's less intrusive.
Well, if you have that, now you're going to start looking at ways to assess what's going on in a little bit more detail.
So when would a person start? When would a person have their first test?
I think you could start that depending on the situation. If you have a family history of that, or you have other risk factors that would tend to put you in a category of being at an increased risk, if you didn't exercise, if your diet was poor, if you're overweight, all those things, you might want to start even at age 35 or 40.
Well,
but it's an inexpensive test.
The thing that's so great about it is it's preventive, it's predictive, it's reversible.
Absolutely.
And let's talk about a supplement, L-arginine. How does that work to help?
It's an interesting thing to add to it. What it does is it dilates up arteries that are constricted. And so if you have arteriosclerosis, it may actually reverse some of that plaque that's there.
It reduces the stiffening.
It can reduce the stiffness. It's one way to go.
So we need to encourage mainstream medicine to keep it simple and encourage prevention and use this vascular stiffness test.
Right. And now what we do at the Health Medicine Center, where I practice, is we add two other tests to it. We do one that's called a heart rate variability test, which I think is really useful as a predictor of all-cause mortality. There's no test more predictive than that of all-cause mortality, as well as of heart attack and probably of stroke as well. And the third, and that's inexpensive as well. And all that measures is how regular the heartbeat is. If you've got a heartbeat that's very regular, like a metronome, you're in deep pucky. You would think that a nice regular heartbeat would be exactly what you want to have to be able to stay healthy, but not true.
Well, you want it to change if you're exercising or sleeping.
Yeah, or if you have some emotional things that happen. And the third test that we do is a live blood cell analysis, which looks at the coagulation problems that we see in people who are at risk for having heart disease, because that's what is the final blow in causing heart attacks. We're at the end of the show and want to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news and health the first and third Mondays of every month on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on DrSaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
And have a great time until our next show. We'll see you next time.
We'll be right back.